both Big Ten teams are underdogs here on Tuesday of Final Four week. Both Duke and Kentucky are favored by 5 right now for this weekend. Jeff Seidel of the Free Press got a pic of Tom Izzo and Mark D'Antonio hugging Sunday night at Breslin Center after the basketball team arrived back home, and it went ballistic on social media. It went viral on social media. Seidel says it's been favorited or retweeted more than 1,000 times, not surprisingly. I mean, the magic these two guys have created in tandem has been really something special. This is Tom's 7th trip to the Final Four. D'Antonio's teams have finished in the top 5 in the country 2 straight years. So between these two BFFs and the emotional encounter between Denzel and Carlton Valentine after the game on Sunday, there's a lot of emotion in the air here this week, to be sure. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could be with us here on Tuesday, the last day of March. The month is just all but hours behind us. In and around the state capitol, the month included more questions about the fate of Proposal 1, some tension inside both major parties regarding priorities, including education and improving employment numbers. To take a look back on Current State's month in review, we welcome back Rick Pluta, State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Mark.
And welcome as well to Susan J. Demas, publisher of the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter and regular columnist for MLive. Susan, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
There's so much buzz regarding Indiana's new religious freedom law and what it may or may not mean for Michigan. I thought I'd ask you both at the top here about what's happening. Remind our listeners what's happening on this front in our state. I know Republican State Rep Mike Shirky is sponsoring...
State Senator.
Beg your pardon. Senator Mike Shirky is sponsoring one proposal, but there are other related proposals in play here. As you examine the tea leaves, Rick, how likely is it that Michigan could pass a RFRA law?
Well, I think it's still very possible that the legislature will take up the question, but actually, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, by signing this law and the subsequent blowback from the business community, the NCAA is talking about rescheduling games, the National Conference of Mayors, which is meeting in San Francisco this year. Some mayors are saying that they should move the 2016 conference from Indianapolis next year. We're seeing all kinds of business blowback that Mike Pence might actually have done more to stall any movement on RFRA, as it's called here in Michigan, than anything the American Civil Liberties Union could have done.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, a similar law was being debated last session in lame duck,
yes.
And it actually ended up dying. But there are many, many proponents for it. And I would not be surprised if at some point we do see a renewed debate on this law, but certainly there will be a lot more scrutiny than there was the last time.
Shirky's hopeful of hearings and a vote still this spring, according to the Free Press this morning. Where is the governor on religious freedom law?
On this particular religious freedom law, he's quite skeptical, and the experience in Indiana will give him, more to argue that this should not be done. And if it is done, then it should be in tandem with something that clarifies, what a Religious Freedom Restoration Act is about doing and not doing. In the legislature, there's some sense of urgency about doing something on this because, of course, we have the United States Supreme Court marriage case pending with arguments coming in late April.
Could we see a RFRA measure enacted and Elliot Larson expanded? Could both of those two things happen and coexist?
That's what was on the table during the last session. But Speaker of the House Kevin Cotter, a Republican from Mount Pleasant, says he is not interested in the Elliot Larson portion. He is interested in the religious freedom portion. Mm-hmm. The governor has given some indication that he is interested in both.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when we've talked about this in other states, because this question has come up a lot when, people say, well, this is not about, LGBT rights discrimination, things like that the key distinction where those, rights are protected or not is where they're enumerated, usually in a separate civil rights law. So that would make the distinction between, what's happening in Indiana and a lot of, in Illinois and what we've seen in a lot of other places. And that presumably would be what the argument would be here in Michigan.
Rick Pluta and Susan Demas join me for Current State's Month in Review for the month of March here on 90.5 WKAR. Let's move on to Prop 1. The vote on increasing Michigan's sales tax by a penny is 5 weeks from today. Recent Prop 1 polling from MERS doesn't suggest a whole lot of minds are being changed, that it's still an uphill slog for...
I don't think I've seen any poll that has it winning. Am I missing any, Susan?
I don't.
No. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think so. 36% yes, 55% no, and opposition rises to 63% after people read the proposal.
One of the things about this is, I guess... One of the questions is, what are you measuring? That it does seem like, by and large, the public is to say the least skeptical about Proposal 1 and the promises that go along with it. But what a poll like this particular election is very hard to poll turnout or likely turnout. Because it's a very, these May elections are, they're typically local millages. They're very low turnout. We don't have anything it's the only thing on the statewide ballot. We don't have any other issues or candidates or elections to draw people out on it. And so it's largely unknown who will actually, get out and vote on this.
What accounts for the skepticism, Susan, in your view?
Well, I don't think that the Yes campaign was very aggressive until a few weeks ago. We have seen plenty of commercials, and the governor has been out there on the stump. But when you're asking people for a significant tax increase, you need to start right away to define the issue. And that's something that the Yes campaign waited on for quite a while. We're not talking about an insignificant amount of money. This is going to raise over $1 billion, and you will pay for it with every purchase you make. Just
closer
about.
To two, actually. I think it's 1.9 altogether.
Yeah, and the money, it's supposed to be a ballot proposal for road funding, but this money that's going to be raised by increasing the sales tax does not go directly to roads. It replaces money that will be drawn from other sources that will that will go to roads. And also, I wonder if, in fact, Proposal A does not succeed in May, if the Yes campaign won't look back on it and think that it was a mistake not to have some kind of alternative on, if not on the ballot, at least out there to talk about. Because right now, it's the Yes campaign is very public safety oriented, and it's this or nothing. And I'm just, this is anecdotal, but I'm hearing saying like, well, if this is that big a deal, if it's really this or nothing, how bad can it be, or how sincere is that particular claim?
I'm wondering if it's widely accepted that there is no plan B,
there is not.
Well, the plan B is the status quo, which people may not be satisfied with, but at least they have more money in their pocket. So no one really believes that we're not going to fix any more roads at this point. It's just a matter of how bad the roads will be and how much we can put up with.
Whether or not they really believe that the legislature is without alternatives when it comes to dealing with this.
I'm just wondering if enough voters on May 5th come to the conclusion that there is no plan B and that the roads are bad enough that enough people will think, hey, no way I want to go back to square one on this thing. I'll hold my nose and vote yes.
I think that the Yes campaign is hoping that, at least 51% of the voters smack a pothole on their way to the polls.
Republican Representative Peter Lucido of Macomb County thinks there is a plan B. It involves, interestingly, the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Fund, which pays out benefits to seriously injured car accident victims in our state. Here's Representative Lucido on WLNS-TV and off the record a couple of days ago.
There's $18 billion in that fund. That $18 billion right now is generating $730 million in interest alone. If the taxpayers put that money into that fund, why don't we take it out of that fund?
Lucido's convinced there's a plan B.
That's a fantasy.
What makes that a fantasy?
Right now, I mean, the legislature would have to change the law to raid that fund, which, I mean, they certainly could. But that is money that is supposedly set aside to take care of people who've been in catastrophic accidents with you know, very, very severe injuries after their regular insurance benefits run out, that you would see a ferocious pushback from the insurance industry. You would see a ferocious pushback from the medical community. You know, now you're bringing the whole auto no-fault controversy into play on that. It's just so many moving parts. I just don't – I mean, feel free to argue with me on this, either you, but I don't see the path to that happening.
Argue with you?
Imagine the backlash of parents bringing in their severely disabled children from car accidents to testify about how their funds are being raided? This could be a nightmare.
Let's move on to another topic here from March on Current State's Month in Review. Not unlike the last couple of years, House Republicans are hardly a rubber stamp for Governor Rick Snyder's agenda. This month it was Mr. Snyder's proposed education budget. He proposed significant resources for a third grade literacy initiative, career and technical education, and adult education. The House cut or reduced all of those programs. What's going on here?
Well, the House has their own agenda and how they think that the funds should be spent for education. You know, we may have a looming problem of fund shortages all the way around, especially if Proposal 1 goes down. And so these cuts may become a reality that everybody has to deal with. Mm-hmm. But there's always the push and pull between the legislature and the governor, you know, often regardless of, you know, if they're from the same party, because, you know, they have ideas of how the money should be spent. And in this case, House Republicans would rather just give the schools the money and they can spend it as they see fit.
You know, this has been kind of a philosophical debate in the legislature for, I'd say, a good two or three cycles, that some school districts are coming in and saying, look, instead of parsing out the funds for, you know, all these different special areas, they're called categoricals, just roll it into one, let us decide what our greatest needs are, and then we'll apportion the money.
The conservatives don't like targeted funds. Is that a way to summarize this?
Yeah. But even, you know, but some of them represent small districts that actually benefit overall from those targeted funds. And so, you know, as we often see in the school funding debate, that in the end, this may not break down along, you know, lines of R's and D's as much as, or in this case, R's and D's and governors, as much as what benefits a critical mass of the school districts in my House or Senate district.
Also relating to education this month, the Snyder administration reassigned control of the State Office of School Reform from the Department of Education to DTMB, Technology Management and Budget. Here's Governor Snyder explaining.
I just felt it was a good opportunity to say, let's be more active about helping the lowest performing schools. And this is a way to do it in terms of giving us a bigger role, bigger voice, and making sure we're doing the best we can for those challenged schools.
And let's work in some negative response here while we're at it. We'll hear from both sides all at once. This is a Democratic State Rep. Brandon Dillon.
It hasn't worked. It's not going to work. And simply just transferring the functions to the governor is not going to change the fact that the model is broken and doesn't work.
Is this safely described as a takeover, Rick, or how do you interpret this?
It's kind of a smackdown. This was, first of all, Governor Snyder saying to the State Board of Education, I don't trust you to do the job of, you know, of school reform, especially for the lowest performing schools, that, you know, he already stepped outside, you know, the education establishment to try and set up an education achievement authority, an independent entity to take care of the state's lowest performing schools. Right now, just school districts in Detroit, but he'd like to expand it. This is saying, as you know, the board is the verge of finalizing an agreement with the state superintendent designate Brian Whiston, that he doesn't trust them to do the job, and so he's going to take it over for good or for ill.
Susan?
Well, there's a clear partisan divide here. The governor is a Republican. The right. State Board of Education is majority Democrat, heavily so. And so, you know, there's a fight going on there about who should really be in charge of education reform. And the governor is using his discretion to play a bigger role in this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can always it's kind of an easy way for a governor to, you know, put his thumb in the eye of the board, because the Board of Education, just because the weird division of responsibility that we have over education policy in this state is always clamoring for relevance, in the process of setting education policy. And we saw John Engler do it time and time again. He didn't use the Department of Technology Management and Budget. In fact, it did not exist during his administration. But he liked to pluck things out of the Board of Education realm and put it into the Department of Treasury under, his dominion.
What does this move mean specifically with regard to the EAA? Does it give it some kind of new lease on life? Does it take pressure off it? What?
I think in the grand scheme of things, it may be something of a modest move, that the EAA will still be out there working independently. This is just the governor having a direct pipeline to that effort, as opposed to having to go through the Department of Education, the education establishment. And I think the move is much symbolic message sending as it is anything else.
Michigan's jobless rate dropped a few days ago to its lowest point in 13 years, 5.9%. Put this in perspective here for us. Is this thanks to Governor Snyder and his Republican colleagues, or as others suggest, is it in spite of Governor Snyder and his colleagues?
Well, governors and presidents always get too much credit and too much blame for the state of the economy. And so, that's the case anytime. Certainly it's good news for everybody for the unemployment rate to be down. We had a decade-long recession here. And we are still above the level of, the national economy.
Mm-hmm. But we're finally within half a percentage
point.
That's
right. It's like 6/10 of a percentage point, I think.
And so, obviously, this is news that Governor Snyder has heralded, and he will take credit for. What remains to be seen are some of the other economic indicators, like, personal income growth, because, that affects a lot more people than just the unemployed.
Yeah. I mean, it was nominal, but one of the, a sour note in all of that good news was hours and hourly earnings were down slightly, that the Detroit numbers were not particularly improved. We still have a high rate of combined unemployment and underemployment. So, I mean, there's certainly it's the number that everyone looks at. And so it's certainly good news. And it is better than a poke in the eye.
To see it below six, it jumped out.
It's been a long time since we've been below six. And all of a sudden, on the horizon, you could see that, 3 or 4, percent unemployment rate that is statistical full employment.
We're running out of time, but we got time just enough to hear from State Rep Harvey Santana of Detroit from last Friday night on Off the Record. I've got to play this. We're accustomed to an ideological split on the political right between mainstream Republicans and the Tea Party. There is a split to talk about on the left, though, as well, and it involves Representative Santana, who was kicked out of the Democratic caucus last month, despite his role as minority vice chair of House Appropriations.
Because of it.
Because of that. You're right. On OTR Friday night, Representative Santana was quite clear about the differences he has with what he labeled the progressive caucus. Here he is.
If you look at my campaign literature, you're not going to see that I'm a champion for LGBT issues. You're not going to see that I went up to Lansing to protect your ovaries. You're not going to see that I'm going to try to take your gun away. I live in a violent neighborhood. I need my gun. You're not going to see that I'm trying to support a liberal suburban male agenda for my city, because his agenda is only about downtown Detroit. My agenda as a Democrat begins in the neighborhood with that 16-year-old that I talked to last week that said, "The hell with school. I'm going to go sell dope. I got to get paid." So if you're a progressive and you believe in social justice, then you should be with me, because I am a Democrat.
So, Susan Demas, is Santana an outcast, or are there other Democrats who actually agree with him?
Perhaps, but Harvey Santana has always not really played nicely with others. He did get into a fight with a colleague on the House floor not too long ago, so I'm not sure that this is an ideological discussion as much as a personality clash.
He's a renegade.
Okay. We want to thank both of our guests for helping put March in some perspective for us. Rick Pluta is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Susan Demas is the owner of Inside Michigan Politics newsletter and also appears on MLive. Thanks, guys. MSU Assistant Professor of Advertising and Public Relations Henry Brimmer has gained some notoriety for his entries in the Grand Rapids Art Prize. An exhibition of his works is opening today at the MSU Nisbet Building. Current State Scott Pohl stopped by yesterday while Brimmer was putting the finishing touches on More or Less. Scott, remind us what Brimmer's piece was in the Art Prize last year.
Henry Brimmer was an Art Prize finalist last year for a work called There's Something Happening Here. It was made up of silhouettes on the roofs of downtown buildings. It later came to Old Town Lansing for a while. This exhibition in the Nisbet Building opens with a reception at 3:30 today, and visitors will see Brimmer works dating back to the early 80s. At the time, he was teaching graphic design at the San Francisco Academy of Art. He and another instructor started a magazine called Photo Metro, which published works by famous photographers and students alike.
We thought that the well-known would be important in a way sort of to validate the magazine, but also to educate the younger generation. So our commitment was from the very get-go to publish as much work by unknown photographers as we could, because we thought that was a function. We were both educators and we work with students, and we knew that venues for students to get their work out or younger photographers were far and in between, so we thought let's do that. It was a privilege, naturally, working with the well-known people who were always very willing to talk to us and have us publish their work. We did Ansel Adams. Maybe we did the last interview with Ansel Adams. We did Marion Post Walcott. We did Annie Leibovitz. We did some really big names in photography. But in between there, we also did hundreds and hundreds of just beginners or people with no names, some of whom, we're proud to say we were the first to publish their work. You know, it just was amazing.
And it was free.
Yes, we were incompetent business people. We wanted to do a magazine, and we found that the trappings of charging for a magazine were too much work. It meant that you had to deliver the magazine and come and pick the money up that people collected. It meant that you had to then count the magazines that were sold, take the other ones. It was just too much work that we didn't want to do, and we felt that the formula of guaranteeing distribution to our advertisers that were basically the photo labs and the small camera shops or the schools that taught photography, that it was well worth the exchange. We said we print 12,000 copies every month. You can be absolutely sure that all the copies are going to go because nobody has to pay for them. They'll just pick them up.
We're talking with Henry Brimmer, an artist who has an exhibition of his work at the Nisbet Building on the MSU campus. Along with the photography associated with Photo Metro, people will get a glimpse into what it was like to publish a magazine in those days, pre-digital publication techniques.
Yes, I've been carrying for years and years and years, I've been carrying all these bits and pieces of Fotometro, like a little archive of the plates, the printing plates and the color keys and the handmade knockouts for covers and things like that. So part of the exhibition, in a way, is going to be about printing and, you know, how something came together in those days when we were not using the computer. We most probably shifted to the computer about 86 or 87. We were one of the very first publications that did everything on the computer. It was very early days of digital photography, and we used programs that were anteceded Photoshop, even in digital darkroom, just really basic programs that then led to other things. For us, it meant independence because we were able then to do everything ourselves and, you know, not have to pay the typesetters and not have to do this and that. And it worked really well.
Observers who are familiar with you, Henry Brimmer, through exposure to your projects at the Grand Rapids Art Prize will get to revisit at least one of your early Art Prize entries called Touch Wood. There's a lot of the planning process involved with Touch Wood that will be on display here too.
Yeah, Touchwood was the first Art Prize project I entered. I already had a lot of work that related to wood, and I don't know exactly why, but I have an affinity to the material and enjoy working with it and just looking at it, touching it, whatever. Most of my projects are also an opportunity to learn about things. And so I worked with Walt over in the woodshop in the art department, who helped me cut 17,000 little houses, tiny houses. And I worked with a variety. I got a big chunk of a beam from a barn that the Michigan Historical Barn Association gave me that is a beautiful piece of wood that weighs a ton. It's amazing solid wood, and I worked and sanded it and did stuff to it. It was just wonderful to work with your hands and do something different in this age of digital, to touch things sometimes even get a little bit hurt and smell things and all these things. It's just really a wonderful experience.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if you're planning another Art Prize entry and if we'll see any hint of it in this exhibition in the Nisbet building.
I've had an idea for 3 years already of doing a piece that it's a figure that actually spans from the rooftops that I've always worked with all the way to the floor where cars would have to drive through the open legs of the figure. And it's a very costly project. And what I'm finding out, though, now, unfortunately, is that my last project, which was There's Something Happening Here, which became a little bit controversial, is starting to actually close some doors for me. I think that people, the building owners, the real estate people, and are a little bit afraid because the media started to talk about snipers on the roof and stuff like that, which was really never the intention. It was about security. And there were no snipers. Somebody said snipers, and the media ran with it, and it became sort of like an identifier for the project, which really was not about that at all. But Art Prize supports me. Even Rick DeVos, whose family owns a couple of buildings in Grand Rapids, has said that if I run into trouble, I should come to him and he will try to help me. So I do hope that I'll pull something off, but I don't mind sitting out one art prize. It's getting to be a lot of work and a lot of fundraising. I would have to raise $60,000 to do the figure, and I don't know that I can manage it in this short a time.
You can see an exhibition of Henry Brimmer's works called More or Less at the Nisbet Building on the MSU campus through May 14th. Henry Brimmer, thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, we talk to an MSU researcher who says the biodegradable plastic cups you're buying in an effort to be green might not be that much better for the planet than traditional plastics. Plus, the volunteer organization Kiwanis International boasts countless chapters in over 80 countries, but it actually got its start right here in Michigan. We'll hear from local historian Sam Stahl about the club's Detroit roots. Stay tuned. It's Current State on WKAR.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fuller,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
The morning's news on your way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
WKAR is supported by Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce's special evening featuring Urban Magic Johnson on Thursday, April 30th from 5 until 8 p.m. at the Lansing Center. Ticket information at lansingchamber.org. And by Hayes Green Beach Memorial Hospital, providing women's health care through Journey at Alive and at its breast care center, led by Dr. Troy Ferguson, offering monthly breast cancer risk assessment classes. HGBHealth.com.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. A new study out of Michigan State finds that some additives that supposedly help plastic bags biodegrade really aren't effective. Current State's Melissa Benmark joins us now. And Melissa, give us an idea what got covered in this research then.
Well, Mark, one of the things this conversation taught me was that issues of biodegradation and recycling are actually a lot more complicated than just, you know, good plastic versus bad plastic. I talked to a co-author of the study, Dr. Susan Selke, who's the interim director of packaging and also a professor in MSU School of Packaging. And I first asked her to give me kind of a baseline of what's considered ideal biodegradation in terms of how fast it happens.
First of all, it's not a matter of just what things biodegrade quickly or slowly, but also what circumstances they biodegrade in. So, for example, food is eminently biodegradable. We degrade it ourselves all the time. But you put food in a landfill, you keep it dry, oxygen gets used up. It's been well established that you can dig up landfills after 10, 20 years and still find food. I've seen pictures of chicken still clinging to the bone, corn still on the cob, carrots that are still orange inside, though they're really black and ugly outside. So if the circumstances aren't designed to promote the action of microorganisms, which is what we usually mean by biodegradability, that microorganisms can use the material as a food source, then unless we arrange things so that that's facilitated, it doesn't happen very fast.
I would guess an ideal environment would be moist and with a lot of oxygen, maybe?
That's exactly right. And we do that. We have composting operations that are designed to encourage biodegradation to happen. So it's much, much faster than in a landfill, which is designed to discourage biodegradation.
So tell me about the study, what you looked at and what you were looking to find out.
The essence of the study is that we had been asked by companies who were approached by sellers of packaging materials with the argument that the companies could have more environmentally friendly packaging if instead of the plastics they were using, they used these alternative plastics that had additives added to them that claimed to make the plastics biodegradable. So our fundamental question was, in the common types of environments that these packages are likely to end up, is there benefit from using these materials or not, benefit from an environmental perspective? So do, in fact, you get faster biodegradation if the additives are there than if they're not?
And what did you find?
What we found is that for the additives we tested and the environments we tested, we did not see any significant differences between the plastics with and without the additives.
It seems to me this could cause some consternation amongst plastic producers, people who produce the additives, the industry. What have you? Is there any fallout that has happened that you can that you're free to talk about?
Well, two of the manufacturers of additives that we've tested have put out press releases that, in essence, say our tests were flawed. We didn't understand what their additives were supposed to do, and one of them said that we wasted 4 years of work.
That the study you just did wasted 4 years of work?
Yes, and it was only a three-year study.
When people buy the water bottles and it says, this is a special kind of plastic that biodegrades, so it really doesn't make that much difference.
I want to be clear. There is a big difference between plastics that are inherently biodegradable, and there are some, and plastics that are not inherently biodegradable, where the claim is that you mix these other ingredients in and it causes them to become biodegradable. So water bottles specifically. Most water bottles are made out of PET, which is a non-biodegradable plastic. There are some water bottles that are made out of PLA, polylactide, which does biodegrade in certain types of environments. If you have an industrial compost facility, PLA does biodegrade.
So people, if they're wanting to be conscious of this, I mean, can you see on the label of, you can see that on the label of a water bottle. Are there other places, like, for instance, your plastic bags that you can see what it's made out of?
Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But something that I would like consumers to think about is, in general, recycling preserves a lot more value than biodegradation. So plastic water bottles, if they're PET, which doesn't biodegrade, is very, very recyclable. They're organized recycling programs. Recycling rates are pretty high. It's a valuable material that we can keep using again. If something biodegrades, you can certainly argue that that's better than persisting in the environment without having any use. But if it can be recycled, then we're avoiding the use of new material to make new products.
And energy output.
Absolutely.
I'm really struck by a lot of our stories these days, our environmental stories on the program are about plastic microbeads in the lake, floating plastic in the Pacific. In your case, you know, plastic that doesn't break down. And yet we're so dependent on it. And you're someone who looks at packaging for a living. What are your thoughts about what comes after plastic? You know, what is after plastic?
Let me comment a little bit on the plastic persisting in the environment, like the microbeads. That is a big problem. And I do want to be clear that water environments, whether ocean or freshwater, were not one of the environments that we looked at in our study. Badly managed disposal of plastics is a serious environmental problem. And sometimes the choice of the material, the design of the system, can reduce those problems. And that should happen. For instance, I'm an advocate of not putting plastic microbeads in products. I think that's a common sense approach to minimizing that problem.
Since many plastics come from petroleum products, petroleum is finite. Are you thinking more along the lines of that some new material is going to come along that we're going to discover that will be as ubiquitous as plastic, but maybe a little easier to manage? Or are you thinking maybe we're just going to keep on recycling what we have for as long as we need to?
One of the reasons that plastics have grown so much is that they do provide some real environmental benefits. They're lightweight, they take less energy to form, to transport, and they certainly can be recycled in very many cases. So I don't see plastics disappearing. What I think is going to change, at least to a certain extent in the future, is where we get the basic building blocks for the plastic materials from. Right now, the vast majority of them do come from petrochemicals. But there is increasing efforts to make bio-based plastics. There's a big difference between biodegradable and bio-based. Bio-based is where you get the starting materials from. Biodegradable is whether you can break those materials back down again. And you can have petroleum-based materials that plastics that are and aren't biodegradable, and you can have bio-based plastics that are and aren't biodegradable.
If you look at sort of the spectrum of things that we recycle and reuse, is it fair to say that for instance, that maybe metal is one of the big success stories? Because I think about, you know, especially in this state with the can return, that people are more conscious of that than maybe they are about what they do with their plastic.
Certainly, there's a very long history of metal recycling, but I think the higher rate for recycling of metal beverage cans than plastic beverage bottles is mostly because the vast majority of metal beverage cans are covered by our deposit law, and a lot of plastic beverage bottles, water bottles, juice bottles, etc., are not.
Well, Dr. Susan Selke, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. This year, Kiwanis International celebrates its 100th birthday. Kiwanis was founded in 1915 in Detroit and became an international organization with the creation of the Kiwanis Club of Hamilton, Ontario, the following year. Now, since then, Kiwanis has grown to over 500,000 members worldwide, with about 6,000 here in Michigan. Sam Stahl is the author of the recent Michigan History Magazine article, Kiwanis International, It All Began in Detroit. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Sam by phone yesterday about a bit of Kiwanis history and its local roots.
Some of the folks who I interviewed were second and even third generation Kiwanians. It was almost a family tradition. I spoke to one guy whose father was actually present when the organization was founded. So that's basically a two-generation spread covering a century.
Yeah. Let's speak a little bit about Sue Petrazin, who is poised to become president of Kiwanis International. That passion is really carried on with her right here in our community.
After joining Circle K, I served as the governor of Michigan for Circle K, which did the same representation at the international level, and then served a year on the Circle K International Board. Was invited to join the East Lansing Club, who I knew because I had been a Circle K member here, and was invited to join their club, and was actually the first female member of the East Lansing Club. So it's been pretty much all my life since 1977.
And I think she sort of demonstrates, I guess, the dogged persistence in that devotion, because when she became old enough to become a Kiwanian, you still couldn't be a Kiwanian if you were a woman.
Right.
There were high school programs, there were grade school programs, but when you wanted to go into Kiwanis itself, you ran into a brick wall. And she worked around the edges of the organization for a while. I think she sponsored the college club there at the for
Michigan,
a while.
Michigan State University.
Michigan State. And finally, in the 80s, they opened up the organization to women, and she joined. I think it speaks to her persistence and her devotion to the group that she would have waited around for them that long.
Right.
And now, of course, she's the president, the incoming president.
Sure. What were some of the things that Kiwanis family members could do to participate before the Age of Enlightenment?
Well, Kiwanis has always had high school programs, even grade school programs, and college programs, all of which were open to women at basically from the beginning. It was only the varsity squad that was men only up until the 1980s. And I believe there was even a women's auxiliary for a while for a Kiwanis, you know, the old women's auxiliary organizations that pretty much all of the men's clubs had back then. But as far as joining the actual Kiwanis club, if you were a woman, I think it was not until the 1980s that you could actually do that. And basically all of the big male-oriented professional organizations, the walls came down about the same time.
Take us back to the early 1900s in this age of the fraternal organization and the genesis of Kiwanis. How did it fit in with that world?
Well, let's go back. Let's return to the days of yesteryear before there was Facebook or anything,
right,
any other way of getting in touch with people. They had this process called actually meeting people face-to-face. I mean, if you wanted a network, you had to go and meet with people. And this was the early 1900s. There were a lot of self-made men. There were a lot of industrialists, a lot of businesses. And, of course, they wanted to get together. Well, how do you do that? You form a fraternal organization. You form a business club. And Kiwanis was just one of many at the time. I think Rotary, which was established in Illinois, was the first or the first big one. But then there were just literally tens and hundreds of them that came along over the years. Kiwanis obviously was one of the biggest. And it started out as a straight-up business organization. Let's get together, let's have meetings once a month, once a week, and just do some deals. I mean, they were very straightforward about that. And it was only a couple of years later that the membership said, you know what, let's maybe do some community service. Let's do that rather than just have this be an old boy network that where we sit around and make deals and smoke cigars.
Right. There's an evolution from a place where, as you said, to have self-made businessmen get some deals together, just a place to commiserate, evolve into a service organization. Why do you think that happened?
What happened was, I mean, this was a big deal at the beginning of Kiwanis, because when the organization was first founded, the man who founded it did it specifically as a business-only organization. We are not having some sort of public service component. We are here to do deals. And within a couple of years, there was a palace coup, and this guy walked away from the Michigan organization because they basically said, we're going to do public service. We want to be involved in the community. We want to have these things happen. You know, we think we can make a difference. And this was just incompatible. I think that originally the Detroit club had about 200 members, and about more than half of them simply walked away when they made this change. But it was a change that, I guess, set Kiwanis up for the growth that they've enjoyed, because it was after they made this change that the group became international in scope. They started adding members, you know, by the tens of thousands over the decades. So this was the winning formula. It wasn't just all altruism. I mean, this was the winning formula that made Kiwanis a big organization.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Sam Stahl. He's the author of a recent Michigan History Magazine article entitled Kiwanis International, It All Began in Detroit, as we talk about the organization founded here in Michigan and its 100th anniversary. You mentioned also, Sam, some of the ideas of charitable work. One of those was a 5,000-acre forest, and another was a tuberculosis sanitarium. I mean, these were some big projects that Kiwanis got involved with early on.
Well, these were some big deal people who were involved. It's hard to imagine, but there was a time when you weren't anybody unless you were a member of a Kiwanis or one of the other major fraternal organizations.
Right.
You know, there was a time when these lunch meetings for the Detroit Club, you know, there'd be 200 people there for lunch meetings. You'd have the mayor. You'd have major figures from all the local industrial enterprises. These were people who could get stuff done on a grand scale, and that's why you would see projects like this. And those were just a couple of things that I mentioned. I mean, this was a constant thing. You had all the movers and shakers together in one room, and so if you wanted to do something, you could get five guys together at a table and get it all worked out.
You also suggest that Kiwanis is or was dominated more by major business figures, auto industry, heavy hitters here in Michigan and the like, but now a growing commitment to those who are interested in the volunteer mission. How has that evolution happened in, say, the last decade?
It used to be that one of the ways corporations did community outreach back in the 40s and 30s, before it was even known as community outreach, was by having their top executives join service clubs. And they would pay their dues. They would not worry about the fact that they vanished once a week to go to lunch meetings. They would cover the expense of the lunch. And, of course, that's changed. Companies don't do that anymore, or mostly don't do that anymore. They don't cover the expenses of joining a club. They don't cover dues and things like that. And they found other outlets as far as, you know, ways to do community service that maybe don't necessarily include a group like Kiwanis. But at the same time, you see more people who are interested in, you know, helping kids or helping their communities who look at a group like Kiwanis and think, I want to do that. And maybe they're not the business heavy hitters that you used to see 50 years ago, but they are perhaps, you know, just as committed or more committed to doing community service. So that's kind of the shift we've seen.
More than 500,000 members worldwide, about 6,000 here in Michigan. Kiwanis International celebrates 100 years. The article's entitled Kiwanis International, It All Began in Detroit. It's from a recent Michigan History magazine article by Sam Stahl. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for Tuesday. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features a mid-Michigan organization that helps people find affordable housing and works with those struggling with foreclosures and evictions in Eaton County. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren was our director today. Thanks as well to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and to Drew Hill for engineering. You can hear past episodes of Current State at WKAR.org or subscribe to our podcast. And on Facebook, just search Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. See you Wednesday. It's Current State on WKAR.